Before we start talking about Jewish history, the first thing we have to try and do is define the word Jewish. Now, that's not a particularly simple thing to do. We've been arguing over what exactly Jewish means for at least 2,000 years, and chances are we're not going to arrive at a conclusion today on this podcast. But it is important to understand that the definition of Judaism, of Jewish, that I grew up with in America, where it was clear to me that it was only a religion, it's important for us to understand that historically that's not the case. That yes, of course, being Jewish includes religious elements, but that's only going to be one small part of it. So, for example, if you were to go into a bookstore, you would expect to find books about Jewish cooking or Jewish humor, and you would never expect to find books about Christian cooking or Muslim humor, right? Because, again, Jewish, it's something larger than a religion, something more encompassing, whereas Christianity and Islam are fundamentally religions. Another good example is to imagine that if I say a word, and then you're going to give me other words in that same category. Right? So for example, if I were to say grape, you might well say peach and strawberry. Right? And if I were to say Jewish, those of us who grew up in the US like me, chances are you'd be saying Christian, Muslim, things like that. But if you historically grew up in a place with Jews, the answer wouldn't have been Christian or Muslim. It would have been Polish or Kurdish or Catalan, right? Something bigger and broader than a religion, what I like to call civilization. Another way to think about it is, I live here in South Tel Aviv, right near the area of town called Jaffa, right, which is a historical biblical city that historically is an Arab area of town. And so there are people in Jaffa who would define themselves as Arab, Christian, Israelis, right? Three different markers that denote their identity. How would my wife, who grew up in Zichron Yaakov as a Jewish woman here in Israel, how would she define herself in those three terms? She's not an Arab, Christian, Israeli. She would be a Jewish, Jewish Israeli, right? That there's something broader there that you can see. Another way to think about it is how you convert to various religions, right? So Christianity, for example, if I were to go to a Christian clergyman and say, you know, that I accept Jesus as my Messiah and that I have full faith in Jesus, at that point, I'm a Christian. That's it. Once I have accepted that matter of faith, I am fundamentally a Christian. Now, a Jewish conversion, whether we're talking about a traditional Orthodox conversion or a modern Reform conversion, the first question the rabbi asks is not going to be, do you accept that there's one God? Now, that might be a part of it, and certainly the idea that there one God is central to the Jewish belief system, but it's going to be a whole series of courses about Jewish law, about Jewish tradition, about the Jewish holidays. There's going to be quite a bit more to it. And even the very, very first convert to Judaism, a woman named Ruth, who you can find in the Bible, in the book of Ruth, when she decides basically to convert to Judaism, what she says is to her mother-in-law, who was Jewish, she decided to stay with, she says, "Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God." Now, again, there's certainly a faith element there, and she does get at the idea that I accept the Hebrew, the Jewish God, as my God, but that's only one part of it. This idea that your people are going to be my people, and I'm going to live among you, that's receives equal attention. That's why, for example, that this idea that Jews are something more than a religion is why my wife can define herself as a secular Jew. It's something that in today's day and age really only makes sense here in Israel. So what does it mean, a secular Jew? Now, if you grew up as a Jew in America, like I did, we tend to sort of belittle Israeli secular Jewish identity because my wife has never been to synagogue. And she honestly hates the idea of going to synagogue. But there are certain ways in which she is fundamentally Jewish that I, growing up, even as a very active Reformed Jew in America, couldn't even have imagined. So, for example, this past Sukkot, that's a Jewish holiday that comes in the fall that chances are, if you grew up as an American Jew like I did, you might have heard of it. You might sort of know basically what it's about, but chances are only a vague idea, and you probably don't do anything to celebrate it at home. And if you go to Sunday school, then maybe when you show up to Sunday school and they've built a sukkah, you think, oh, it's Sukkot, that's fun, and you sit outside in this sukkah, this temporary dwelling place. Well, I was recently at my wife's family. Again, they're very secular. They never go to synagogue. And her parents were so excited that finally all the kids were out of the house and they weren't going to have to build a sukkah this year. And then their adorable granddaughter, my niece, came over and saw that there was no sukkah and nearly broke out in tears because in her preschool, in the same way that I, growing up, would have made Halloween decorations or Thanksgiving decorations, she had made decorations for the sukkah because that was the holiday. That's what they were doing in class. And when she found out that grandma and grandpa weren't going to have a sukkah and there was going to be nowhere to hang her decorations, oh, this was the saddest thing in the whole world. And so, yet again, they ended up building a sukkah in their house, which, for me, even as a very active Reformed Jew, we never even imagined building a sukkah in my house. But we always decorated the house for Halloween, and we always had Thanksgiving. And there are lots of ways like that, that living in Israel, being Jewish, is it's your culture, it's your nationality, it's your civilization. Again, using my wife as an example, she speaks Hebrew every day. We'll talk about Hebrew a little bit more moving forward, but Hebrew is a carrier of Jewish culture. Almost everyone she knows is going to be Jewish. So the society that she grew up in is fundamentally Jewish in ways that no matter how active of a religious Jew you might be, if you don't live in a Jewish state, in a Jewish community that thinks of its Jewish identity as its primary identity, chances are you don't necessarily experience it in the same way. This, by the way, helps explain why it is that Jews have a state. That one of the things that you sometimes hear people say about why Israel shouldn't be a state, why there shouldn't be a state, and of course, that's a big question that we're not going to go into right now, is that you'll hear people say other religions don't have a state. Why should Judaism have a state? And the answer is very clearly, being Jewish, it's not a religion. And so in the same way that any other civilization, in my opinion, deserves their own state, then that's why Jews have a state as well. So to try and give a little bit of a sense of how Jewish identity does work, I'm going to introduce two models for thinking about Jewish identity. Now, not that these are the only models, there are certainly many others out there, but to try and help us think a little bit more broadly about what it means to be Jewish so that we can really talk about what Jewish history means and where it starts and how we should be following it. So the first is a model that I think of as the triangle, that there are three elements to it. Am Yisrael, the people of Israel, Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, and Torat Yisrael, the Torah, or the religion of Israel. These three different elements, of course, are somewhat overlapping. I mean, again, we're talking about the nebulous concept of identity. There is no clear dividing lines. But these three things, I think, give at least a broader idea of what it means when we say Jewish. So when we say Am Yisrael, the people of Israel, what we're talking about is the cultural stuff, the language, or really the languages, because it's not just Hebrew. There's Yiddish, there's Ladino, the language spoken by Sephardic Jews, Mediterranean Jews who were kicked out of Spain. There's Judeo-Arabic, the language spoken in Arabic-speaking countries. There's actually a whole series of Jewish languages that help carry this culture. There's Jewish holidays, right? The fact that we build a sukkah in the fall and that we have a Seder in the spring and that there's a holiday for the trees, and on that holiday, that happens to be right when the almond trees always bloom here in the land of Israel. And that connects us to our second part, the land of Israel itself. That if we look at the earliest part of Jewish history, much of it takes place in one particular slice of land, whether we call it Canaan or Judea or Palestine or Israel, this little slice of land here at the eastern end of the Mediterranean is absolutely critical in the Jewish story. And there are, even today, there are many elements of the Jewish people, of the Jewish religion, of the Jewish culture that are related to this specific piece of land. We'll mention some of them a little bit later. And the final element is Torat Yisrael, the religion of Israel. What does that mean? It means the specific holy texts, the specific religious rituals, the moral code that Jews are compelled to live by. And again, these three elements, Am, the culture, Eretz, the land, and Torah, the religion, are of course in many ways completely inseparable. So if we take, for example, the Jewish holiday of Passover. The Jewish holiday of Passover takes place in the springtime. It's a harvest festival here in Israel, and historically, Jews would come to Jerusalem and bring the fruits of their harvest, and they would make a sacrifice of the fruits of this harvest. It's also, of course, a family holiday, so there might be all sorts of cultural traditions that you and your family have, how you sit around the Seder table, which things you bless, and which songs you sing. And of course, it's a religious holiday as well, that it's mentioned in the Jewish Bible, the Tanakh, and it recounts the story of the Exodus from Egypt. So these three elements are frequently combined, but they give a sense of the sort of broadness of Jewish identity. Another model I want to bring up is one that was created by a man named Avram Infeld, who is a very well-known Jewish educator. He was born in South Africa. He lives now in Israel. And he's done quite a bit of work in a variety of institutions trying to create Jewish identity in Jews around the world. And the most famous program he's been involved with was he was one of the first directors of the Birthright program. He helped design it and help get Jews here to Israel. And he's got all sorts of educational materials online, definitely worth checking out. But what I want to bring up is his model of Jewish identity, which he refers to as the five-legged table. And again, I don't want to go into too many details because he has his own website that deals with it a lot, but just to try and give us a sense of how being Jewish is something much broader than just religion. And he says, why the five-legged table? Because a table with five legs, if you have any three of those legs, the table will stand. Now, the table is going to be stronger if you have four legs or even five legs, but with any three of those legs, the table will be strong enough to stand. And so he gives these five different elements of Jewish identity that he says, if you've got at least three of them, you have enough Jewish identity that it'll be a strong part of your identity and something that can be passed on to generations. The other thing that he finds so critical about this idea of these five different elements, of which you have to have at least three to really be a part of, to really have a strong Jewish identity, is that if you've got at least three, you share at least one tenet with every other Jew in the world that has at least three. Even if you have very different concepts of what it means to be Jewish or ways of practicing what it means to be Jewish, if you have at least three of them, that means you're going to share at least one in common. So the five legs are memory, family, covenant, Hebrew, and Israel. And we'll go through them one by one just to give a little bit better of a sense of what we're talking about. When he talks about memory, right, that's very different from history, right? History is perhaps our best account of facts in the past. Memory is the stories we tell ourselves about this history. So to give just one example of how we think about memory is that Jews are all required, even if you converted to Judaism, to see yourself as if you personally were part of the Exodus from Egypt, that you personally were part of the story and that you crossed the Red Sea and stood on Mount Sinai and were released from slavery and that you personally were there. Almost every Jew who moves to Israel that I know has some experience where you go to a Jewish family's house for Shabbat dinner, and they show up, and the person who welcomes you to their home says, you know, I recognize you. And the new immigrant stands and says, I don't think so. I don't think we ever met. And he says, no, you know what? I think you were standing next to me at Mount Sinai. And it gets at this idea that we have this common Jewish memory. The second leg is family. The way we're described in the Jewish Bible, in Tanakh, is Bnei Israel, the children of Israel. That we are all one big family. And that has a number of important consequences, right? First of all, you don't choose your family. And there are certainly many members of my Jewish family that I do not necessarily agree with. But at the end of the day, I still see them as family, as one big mishbucha, right? The Yiddish word for this sort of extended family. By the way, in my life, there is no one in the world that can drive me up a wall like my parents or my siblings or the people that I grew up with, and I think that's pretty typical for family. But at the end of the day, when push comes to shove, I can count on them for anything, and I know they feel the same way about me. And that's what it means that we're all one family, that we may fight and we may squabble and we may yell and scream and tear our hair out, but at the end of the day, we're all one big family. The third leg is covenant. What do we mean by covenant in Hebrew, brit? We mean the covenant we received at Mount Sinai. According to Jewish tradition, after we left Egypt, after we crossed the Red Sea, we went to Mount Sinai and received the covenant from God, right? At least one section of the Jewish Bible. And there's arguments over exactly which part was received and how it was received and how we should interpret that. But every Jew, I think, has his or her worldview influenced by this idea of the covenant. So even, you know, for Orthodox Jews, they take this very literally, right? That there's a covenant with God that at that point, we received the makings of an entire legal system that we're now required to follow. Now, the reform movement that I grew up in didn't see the covenant as binding in that way. But we absolutely saw ourselves as required to do social justice and behave in a righteous way as a result of this covenant we made with God to help repair the world. So this idea of covenant, no matter how you interpret it, strongly influences your view of the world and our obligations in it. The fourth leg is Hebrew. Hebrew, like any other language, is a carrier of culture. So, for example, many of the Inuit languages have many different words for snow, because in the Inuit languages, the people who lived in what's now Alaska, describing the snow was very important. Or in traditional Irish languages, I understand that there's many different words for rain, because in Ireland it rains all the time, and so the language itself contains carriers of the culture. Hebrew is like that too. Hebrew is fundamentally a Jewish language. That it's the language that the Bible is written in, it's the language of Jewish study, it's the language of the modern day of Israel. And it carries all sorts of values that Jews have brought with us for thousands of years. So to give just one example, and I know Reuven's going to talk more about Hebrew, is the word for before, for ancient, kedem, is related to the word for kadima, which means forward. And that's because that for Jews, the past and the future are all connected. They're all part of one link. And so you can hear in kedem and kadima that same KDM root that connects them. And that itself is sort of showing the Jewish view of the world. And finally, Israel, the land of Israel and the state of Israel. There are many elements of Jewish culture, of Jewish religion, that I grew up with that I didn't even necessarily know were related to this particular piece of land. But there are. So, for example, there's a prayer that we say. The most important, I shouldn't say the most important, but the sort of main prayer of the Jewish service called the Amidah, the one that starts with Adonai Sifatai Tiftachu. That's the main part of the Jewish prayer. And there's a certain part in there where you pray for rain. Now, I grew up in Florida, and praying for rain in Florida is a little bit silly because it rains all the time and it's no issue. And what's especially sort of weird about it is that at Passover time in the spring, you stop saying a prayer for rain. Why? Because these ancient prayers come back to the land of Israel. And in the land of Israel, once Passover comes, it ain't going to rain. You can play until you're blue in the face. It's simply not going to rain. And so we actually stop saying the prayer for rain. And we don't start again until Sukkot in the fall when the rainy season in Israel comes again. And we start saying the prayer for rain. Or another example is on a Shabbat dinner, a traditional Jewish meal Friday at sundown when the Sabbath begins. There are three main things we bless: the candle, the bread, and the wine. Why those three? Why don't we bless the pineapple? I love pineapple. I would like to bless pineapple. It's because the three things we bless are the three major agricultural products of the Eastern Mediterranean. Bread obviously comes from wheat. Wine obviously comes from grapes. And candles historically would have come from olive oil. And anyone who's been to Israel knows that olive trees grow all over the place. So every Friday night that my family sat down to say those three blessings, we were actually doing something that was connected to this specific plot of land here in the Eastern Mediterranean. And today, especially with the Jewish state, this is one of the central binding forces of the Jewish people today. Whether we're arguing about it or visiting about it or praying for it or raising money for it or whatever it may be, the state of Israel today occupies a central role in Jewish identity. So that's the five-legged table model. And I hope that exploring these two different models have started to broaden your sense of what it is to be Jewish. Now, why is it that I grew up knowing very clearly that Jewish is a religion? And by the way, I've had a number of people argue with me that everything I just said is completely inaccurate and that, of course, being Jewish is just religion. So how is it that this came to be the case? Well, this came to be the case as a response to the Enlightenment and the Jewish Enlightenment, what's called the Haskalah, where all of a sudden, a few things are happening around the world. First of all, we're moving away from big multi-ethnic empires where there's a whole bunch of different ethnicities, civilizations, whatever we want to call them, and we're moving towards the nation state, which requires a change in identity, right? And around this time, this is when Jews for the first time have at least some ability to leave their exclusively Jewish communities, right? To leave the ghetto. And so when we're given the option to leave the ghetto and to join these new nation states, and I say that as if it were really easy and there was no backlash or anti-Semitism. Of course, the actual story is much more complicated, and whether we were actually able to leave was much more complicated. But in response to this leaving the ghetto and joining these new nation states, there were a number of different Jewish responses. For example, there were some Jews who said, no, thank you. We don't want to join the modern world. We don't want to be a part of this new German nation state, for example. We're going to stick our heads in the sand, and we're going to close the gates, and we're going to stop changing, and we're never going to change ever again. Right? That's the ultra-Orthodox Jews. There are some Jews who said, wait a minute, I can leave this whole 2,000 years of persecution thing? I can get out of here? I'm allowed to assimilate? Great, see you later. And they assimilated. By the way, that was the response of one of the men that we know today as one of the most famous Zionists, Theodor Herzl. His answer to what was called the Jewish question was assimilation. He believed that Jews should assimilate. Of course, events later in his life are gonna change his mind and show him that that's not a possible answer. There's some small group who looks around and says, you know, well, my French friends are forming a French state, and my German friends are creating a German state. I'm Jewish. I want a Jewish state. And those are, of course, Zionists who want to have their own state. The majority of Jews chose some sort of middle path, where they said, I want to maintain some sort of Jewish identity, but I also want to be a part of the modern world. And those responses sort of run the spectrum from reform, conservative, reconstructionist, liberal types of Judaism, all the way up until modern Orthodox, right? Who modern Orthodox said, I want to continue following Jewish law in its traditional strict way, but I also want to get a normal job and study math and science and other modern subjects as well. And it was the Reform Jews in particular who said, how is it I can be fully German or French or British or whatever it is? A lot of this really took place in Germany. That's why I'm using Germany as an example. And they said, in order to fully be a member of German society, I'm going to take my Jewish peoplehood, my Jewish civilization, my Jewish culture, and I'm going to squeeze it all into religion. So there are certain aspects I'm going to get rid of. Well, some of them said, for example, we don't need to speak Hebrew, and we shouldn't speak of ourselves as being in exile, the way that Jews have thought of themselves for the last 2,000 years as being in exile. These new Reformed Jews, especially in Germany, said, well, I'm not in exile anymore. I don't want to go back to Jerusalem. I don't want to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. And so let's stop talking like that. I'm here, home in Germany, or wherever else I might be. And so when my German neighbor goes to his church on Sunday, I'll go to my church on Saturday, and I'm going to call it a synagogue. And I'm going to erase all the cultural, civilizational aspects that might prevent me from fully embracing a modern German identity. And in that way, they turned being Jewish, something that was historically much broader into just religion, they turned it into being just religion. Now, in the modern Reform world, there's now been something of a transition back to reincorporating some of the Jewish cultural aspects. So, for example, there's now much more Hebrew in modern Reform synagogues than there was 50 or 100 years ago in Reform synagogues. But that's the reason that I grew up understanding Jewish as simply a religion. It's because in the world that I grew up in, and for most of the Jews of America, where Jews really were accepted into society on an almost completely equal basis, the Reform Jews, the liberal Jews, were actually quite successful in transitioning Jewish into being simply religion. So I hope that this helped give you a sense of what Jewish really means and what it has meant historically, and the fact that we're a civilization or a people or something much broader. And because of that, we have a history as well. So we'll jump into the history on our next podcast. Thanks.